Difficult texts.
In the old Bible student manual, in the back, you have a section called Epitome of the Faith. And in that section, there's one area called Text Difficult to be Understood at All. And we, as a child, we used to enjoy looking at those texts, and we still do. They are some of the more difficult ones to explain. And a lot of it sometimes relates to translational difficulties, how we interpret the words of Scripture, and how we connect it with the overall theological pattern. I think probably we all have a very natural tendency that when we use translations to more clearly perceive the Word of God, that when we find a discrepancy between translations, our first rule of thumb is, what is the most theologically acceptable? And that's probably the poorest rule we can use. It isn't a wrong rule. It has its place. Certainly there needs to be a harmony to the whole of Scripture. And that which at first look might appear to be more authentic may have enough contradictory evidence that we may accept the second looking most authentic because it fits more in with the overall plan of the ages. But authenticity and being honest in our search for truth must always be the top guideline. In fact, in one of the texts we're going to examine today, we're only going to examine three texts, by the way, but we're going to look at each of them in considerable depth. In one of the texts, we notice that in almost every article that Brother Russell touches it, he said, we felt that this text must be spurious. But since every old manuscript contained it, we have no conclusion but to accept it as genuine, and therefore must deal with it. And I think that that is a good admission of honesty. There are places where it would be much more convenient to cast a difficult text aside and say, well, maybe it doesn't belong. But if the authority is there for it, our idea is to, we must try to find a correct answer to it. In settling translational problems, like in any other decision in life, one of the means we must use is looking at the options. What possible explanations are there for the variations that occur, for the problems that we see before us? Sometimes there's only one option available. Other times there's two or three. One of the cases we're going to look at, there's 11 different possible ways of explaining some of the problems. And then one by one, you discard those options that have the least in favor of them, and the option you end up with may have a few things against it, but it's the most logical, and therefore in faith you accept that as the conclusion. In each of the texts that we're going to look at, we might mention to begin with, we are going to look at more than one possible way of handling the text. As in a study meeting, we're not going to try to force the conclusion to one, though we will state in each case the one that appeals to us the most and the reason it does. So with that in mind, let's look at our first of our three difficult texts today, and it's Matthew, the 27th chapter, verses 51 to 53. A text that is identified in the Bible with the account of the crucifixion of Christ. And behold, the veil of the temple was rent in twain from the top to the bottom, and the earth did quake, and the rocks rent, and the graves were opened. And many bodies of the saints which slept arose and came out of the graves after his resurrection and went into the holy city and appeared unto many. Now you notice that we've underlined certain words, and the graves were opened and went. These are omitted by the Sinaitic manuscript according to the notes of Tischendorf. But they are found in the Vatican manuscript, and most translators do consider them as authentic. In fact, there is very, very little evidence that those words do not belong. But there is at least a Sinaitic which omits those two phrases. Now, the problem, of course, that occurs is, at first reading, this text indicates that there was, at the very least, a resuscitation similar to that of Lazarus for a number of individuals at the time of Jesus' death. And that is the option that Brother Russell uses consistently. As late as reprint 28:11, he deals with that option. feeling that probably these came alive for some unknown purpose. We might suggest that if that were so, to illustrate the power of Jesus' resurrection. And that they again died probably before Pentecost, before the high calling was the thought that he gives. There are several problems in the verse itself. It isn't one simple problem. The four problems that we want to look at in the various options is, who are these saints which slept, which arose? And as we look through the options, we'll notice three possibilities. There is the possibility that they are, in fact, dead individuals who temporarily came back to life and died again. That's one option. There's a second option, that they are merely dead bodies that were cast in an upright position. They were cast upright, did not arise to life, and were thrown out of the graves by the force of the earthquake. And there's a third possibility, that it may have been some of the disciples who had been sleeping in the cemetery, and with the force of the quake, were awakened and arose and came into the city. These are the three possibilities on that aspect. A second thing we want to look at is, leave the same sign on. A second thing we want to look at is the phrase after his resurrection. If these were ones who were dead, why did they wait for 3 days to come out of the graves? If they were awakened by the earthquake at Jesus' death, and that apparently is the earthquake being discussed, why is there a 3-day delay in their coming out of the graves? The third, we're going to look at the phrase, went into the holy city, whether that really in the Greek confers the thought of a motion into the holy city, or whether it is only describing the location of the action, that it was at the holy city. And the fourth thing is, who were the ones to whom they appeared? Were these individuals in the city, or were these travelers into the city? These are the options. Now we're going to look at each of the options in more detail. The first paraphrase that we'll give of this verse would say, and many of the saints, and we're only dealing with the last phrases of the verse, and many of the saints which slept were raised and came out of the graves after his resurrection and were manifested to many in the holy city. This would imply that the bodies of the saints would be dead bodies that would be cast upright in their tombs after Jesus' resurrection, and there they would be manifest by individuals who would go in and out of the city, dwellers in the city who would travel in and out. And I think for the geography, it's good to remember that Jerusalem is surrounded, particularly on the south and the east, by graveyards. It isn't a long distance to the cemetery. You walk outside the city wall, you're in a cemetery. You're right there. It's your road of necessity goes through the graveyards. Now, in favor of this, it would be the ones in Jerusalem going in and out of the city who would notice the bodies lying upright. In other words, it would not be individuals in the city. These appeared in the city to many, but they appeared to many in the city, to many of the city dwellers, that these were going in and out. And it does require only a very minor change in the Greek word order. Against it is the fact that it does require a change. It does not take the Greek text directly as it is. And why the delay in issuing from the graves until after Jesus' resurrection? Why didn't they not come forth immediately? In the 54th verse, the verse immediately following this, it describes the earthquake as though it were the earthquake at the death of Christ. However, one possibility that needs to be mentioned here and will come into play is in Matthew 28:2, speaking of the first day of the week, of the time of the resurrection. And behold, there was a great earthquake, for the angel of the Lord descended from heaven and came and rolled back the stone from the door and sat upon it. So perhaps that the quake spoken of is not the quake at Jesus' death, but the quake at his resurrection. So in this possibility, which we don't think the most likely, it would be the dead bodies cast upright, viewed by travelers in and out of the city. Our second possibility. And many of the saints, many of the bodies of the saints which slept were raised, and being come out of the graves after his resurrection, were taken into the holy city, where they were manifested to many. Now here the thought is that the bodies were actually carried into the city. And that would not be impossible to believe.
because certainly if these bodies have been cast upright, they would need reinterment. It would take time to repair the tombs, to put them back together. In the meantime, there would need to be a morgue, a storage place, and many may have come to view if that were the case. So this possibility certainly does exist as an explanation to the text. It fits in with both the contexts, and it suits the passive voice of the verbs, that they were manifested. They didn't manifest themselves. It was, they were manifested, is the definite thought of the Greek. But it substitutes the words were taken for the questionable words and went with no more authority than the original translators. It also has to make an assumption that the phrase that is translated by most, and went, which as we noted earlier is not in the Sinaitic, although it may be authentic, it takes that phrase out and says, no, they didn't go, they were taken. It makes an assumption on the part of those who make this paraphrase. So for that reason, we think this probably is not the most likely, but a reasonable explanation. The third. Many bodies of the saints which slept were raised and were tossed out of the graves after his resurrection at the holy city, being manifested to many. This places Jesus' resurrection at the holy city and makes the manifestation of the bodies in the graveyards. In other words, the thought is not that they went into the holy city, but leaving out the questionable phrase, and went, it merely says that the location of the event was the environs of Jerusalem. It suits the passive voice. It suits the Greek word order. Matthew 28:2 says that the earthquake of the resurrection opened the Lord's grave. And McClintock and Strong says that it was really only one earthquake that had two major tremors. The one tremor at the time of the Lord's death and the other tremor at the time of the Lord's resurrection. But it was really all part of one seismic eruption. Against it is Matthew 27:54. The immediate verse following the context of these two verses that we're looking at. When the centurion and they that were with him watching Jesus saw the earthquake and those things that were done, they feared greatly, saying, truly this was the Son of God. There appears to be no question that the earthquake the centurion saw was the tremor at the time of the Lord's death, not the time of his resurrection. And therefore, coming out of the graves after his resurrection would have a thought of a different earthquake than the one seemingly referred to in the context. There's also the thought that the Greek ice, while translated at in this variation, is more properly rendered into. The thought is into or unto. Or the verb ice is used, it is usually used of two things coming toward its common destination, but not having arrived at, but coming toward that destination. And therefore, it's an unusual translation to translate it at instead of into, as this variation would require. The fourth. When you look at a number of variations, some of them are slight, the differences, but we want to look at each of them before settling on the final one that we think is the most logical. Many bodies of the saints which slept were tossed upright. Those coming forth from the graves after his resurrection went into the city and informed many. Now, in this case, the observers would be the individuals, anyone, who because of Sabbath law, which closed the gates of the city, were forced to spend the previous night in the cemetery surrounding Jerusalem. This satisfies the Greek word order perfectly. It agrees with the plurality of the verbs. But it does not agree with the passive voice. Inform many appears to be an inadmissible translation, but appear to many appears to be more correct. It's passive, what happened to them, not what they did actively. So the biggest problem with this is the handling of the action in the city. The next. Many bodies of the holy ones which slept were raised and were tossed from their graves. After his resurrection in the holy city, they were manifest to many. Now, this places the event of their being tossed in the graves as being at the death of Jesus, satisfying the context, instead of at his resurrection. That accords with verse 54. This also implies that the tombs affected were tombs within the city walls instead of tombs outside. In the holy city, they were manifest, not by those coming into or that they went into, but they were actually manifest within the holy city. It suits the passive voice, the Greek word order. And it is true, there were graveyards in the city of Jerusalem. In fact, today when you go to the city, they'll show you the tomb of David. These were buried within the city. There were several graveyards on what's called Mount Zion. You may recall seeing pictures from time to time of Hezekiah's tunnel. And you notice that if you're building a tunnel, you would be unlikely to do what Hezekiah did, build a big S shape. It's not the shortest distance between two points. And if you're in a hurry to get from here to there, you don't build that kind of a shape. But the reason they did that was they had to avoid the graveyards. These graveyards were considered sanctified, and therefore they had to avoid going under where these graves were, and so they dug this S-shaped tunnel to avoid that. So it does show that there were tombs in the city, and it could be these tombs that were cast open by the earthquake. It does change the preposition into, going into the city, to in, and Strong says that that's allowable, although not likely. If these graves were within the holy city, the question arises, why were not the people seen until after the resurrection? Because the people could be mingling in the city, although they could not go outside of the city walls. Now this one has, we think, probably more going for it than the earlier explanation we looked at. The objections that are here are quite answerable. In the first place, the tombs within the city would be more likely to be affected by the earthquake than the tombs on the Mount of Olives, for the simple reason that we know the tomb affected the area where Jesus was crucified, which was the opposite side of the Mount of Olives from Mount Moriah. So the first place the earthquake would shake, the hardest shaking, would tend to be directly within the city itself, more than across the Kidron Valley and the graveyards on the Mount of Olives. Secondly, although being in the city would imply that people had concourse and could move about, the Jews were very faithful in trying to keep Sabbath law. And in keeping Sabbath law, most of them didn't leave their houses. So in not leaving their houses, it may be that they did not see these bodies and observe them until a few days after, or if it had been noticed by a few, it was not noised around and became an object of being seen. So there are some definite possibilities to this explanation that the tombs evolved were not tombs outside, but inside the city. Number 6. And many bodies of the saints which slept arose and came out of the graves after his resurrection and went into the cities and appeared unto many. In the holy city appeared to many. The explanation here is that many godly ones, just as Lazarus, were raised to show the power of Jesus' resurrection. These either died before Pentecost or later accepted the high calling and consecrated. Either of those possibilities would exist. One of the things that really favors this is the word saints. The word saints in the New Testament is always translated from hagios as a noun and refers to a spiritual class. The word is used in the Old Testament of Israel. So there's nothing wrong with applying it this way, although if these did later consecrate, they could have become saints. It agrees with the majority of the translators. It fits in well with the explanation of Brother Russell, where he said that he felt that probably this was the most logical explanation. It does not suit the passive voice of the verbs. It seems unusual that such an act would not warrant greater mention. It would seem that if there had actually been a resuscitation, it would have even got historical mention, but certainly would have gotten wider mention in the Gospels as being something that was truly outstanding, and why only mention such an obscure passage. It may seem out of harmony to some of us with the principles of divine justice, although I think that can be easily reconciled. Option 7. In case you're getting tired of options, there are 11. Many bodies of the saints which slept were raised, and, being come out of the graves, were manifested to many after the resurrection who went into the holy city. Now, in this case, the viewers are general travelers. They're in and out of the city following the Sabbath and the resurrection of Jesus. They wouldn't be traveling before the resurrection because of the Sabbath laws. Therefore, they would not be seen until after the resurrection. It perfectly suits the passive voice. The verb being come out is an irregular verb and in the passive. It does call for a major shift in the Greek word order. It transposes entire prepositional phrases. It also uses the questionable words and went and inserts the word who for Anne. Who went into the city instead of Anne went into the city? That is almost minor because that's the same implication even with the word Anne. A definite possibility that it's saying that bodies that were lying in graves outside of the city were thrown upright in the tombs, could not be seen until after Jesus' resurrection because the travelers were not going in and out. And the travelers going in and out afterwards therefore saw this and came back and said, you wouldn't believe what we saw in the cemetery. We saw this amazing sight, all these bodies laying outside of the tombs. A very logical explanation. Number 8. And the graves were opened, and many of the saints sleeping there arose. They came out of the graves after his resurrection and went into the holy city where they appeared to many. Now in this case, the sleeping ones would be the disciples. These also were saints, and they were sleeping in the cemetery. Very probably, because they would have stayed around, if not at the site of the crucifixion, certainly nearby. In their fright, they still had their interest in the Lord and what happened to him. When the gates of the city closed, they had no home to go to. Therefore, the logical place was to do like many travelers did. You sleep on the ground. And the ground around Jerusalem was cemetery ground. The earthquake in the morning of Jesus' resurrection would have certainly woken them up. It would have woken any of you up who were laying there. And you would have gone into the holy city because the gates were open. And he would have appeared to many. It's very logical. It retains the word order. It's logical. It's for the same reason we mentioned earlier, that they would not have had earlier access to Jerusalem. But it's very unusual to use the term bodies. Here we omit the word bodies in this paraphrase. But it's in the Greek. Many bodies of the saints arose. Now, if you go to sleep and you woke up, I don't say your body arose. It's true it did. It got on its feet and it probably put his clothes on and took one leg off the floor at a time and walked around and talked. But we don't speak of it that way. It's not the usual phraseology. We would be more inclined, as the paraphrase suggests, the saints sleeping there arose, not their bodies arose. And their entry into Jerusalem and appearing to many would hardly be noteworthy. They'd done this many times. There was nothing unusual about their going to the city and appearing. However, there is a text that supports this viewpoint, and that is in the last verse of the Gospel of Luke. And this is talking much, much later. This is talking 40 days after the resurrection of Christ at his ascension. We're going to pick up our reading in verse 50 of Luke 24. And he led them out as far as to Bethany. He lifted up his hands and blessed them. And it came to pass while he blessed them, he was parted from them and carried up into heaven. And they worshipped him, and they returned to Jerusalem with great joy and were continually in the temple, praising and blessing God. Amen. Luke does mention, as being noteworthy, the return of the disciples to Jerusalem. He does not mention it immediately after the resurrection. He mentions it 40 days after. Noteworthy probably to show their courage. That as ones identifying with Jesus, they also were outlaws. And to come daily into the temple would take a great deal of courage. So it is possible when it says that after his resurrection, it doesn't mean the next day after, but 40 days after. The same account that Luke is referring to, and it may be a account that is repeated in Luke. So there is additional support for this concept, although we feel somewhat weak. Number 9. Many bodies of the saints which slept were raised and were tossed out of the graves. After his resurrection at the holy city, they were manifest. This is very similar to one of the earlier explanations. It connects the holy city with Jesus' resurrection and not with the appearance of the raised one. And that's merely a punctuation change. Where you put the punctuation? After his resurrection at the holy city. It suits the passive voice in the Greek word order. But again, it has the trouble with the Greek eis. It's an unusual translation for it. And it must presume the pronoun they before the word were manifested, although that is a very logical presumption. So this does fit in with the earlier one, only slightly varying the option that's there. We'll just go on to number 10. Speaking of these verses, the Farrar Fenton translation adds a footnote. These verses are evidently an early note of a transcriber, not part of the original text. Now there's an easy answer. Let's just make the verses spurious. Then we don't need to treat them. We can just cast them aside. And Fenton is not alone. Various early commentators prefer this. They find the concept of a resurrection contrary to Christian belief at the time. In favor of that is even our oldest manuscripts, the Vatican, the Alexandrian, the Sinaiticus. Their transcriptions are copies of originals. It's possible a copyist impressed with the tradition could have added to the originals. That's very possible. But against it, it seems unusual that so many manuscripts would have passed by this without notation. In fact, there are many manuscripts that make it a point to note where there are footnotes, to note where there are incorporations that don't belong. And you would think that at least one or two of these would have picked this up. I think the key to rejecting this lies in the last statement of the note. The commentators who don't like it say this is contrary to Christian belief. It's a decision made more on theology than on scholarship. It is not a decision based upon the manuscript evidence, but we're having a hard time with this text, let's make it spurious. And brethren, that's a problem we've got to be careful to avoid ourselves, that we don't do the same. But we think that since Fenton does note it, it should be concluded among the options that are there. Now, before we get to the last option, because the last option is going to be identical with one of the earlier ones, but it's from a different perspective. Having all these possibilities before us, I think it tends to boggle all of our minds. How do you sift and sort between that number of options? How do you determine which of these is the event being described? And I think that one thing needs to go for any given option. It needs to easily fit at least a reliable Greek manuscript. If it does not fit, there needs to be a reasonable explanation why it does not fit. There is a manuscript that we're going to look at next that has a variation from the accepted, the King James, supporting one of the earlier concepts very well. We put it as a separate option because this time it's translational. It's a manuscript difference. So let's look at our last option. What we would suggest is the answer to the problem of this text. It's the Codex D, or the Codex Bezae manuscript. It reads this way. Tombs were laid open. Many bodies of those buried there were tossed upright. In this posture, they projected from the graves, and they were seen by many who passed by the place on the way back to the city. Now, that thought we've mentioned before. That's not unusual. But in this case, not only does it suit the passive voice and plurality of the verbs, but the Codex D, or the Codex Bezae, is one of the oldest and most reliable manuscripts. It dates to the time of the Sinaitic and the Vatican, 3rd century manuscript. It's highly regarded and does need to be taken into account as being very reliable evidence. Against it is the fact that the other old manuscripts, the Vatican, the Alexandrian, the Sinaiticus, all disagree with it. And this one uses both phrases that are considered spurious by the Sinaiticus. The fact that they went into the city and the fact that the graves were open. You'll notice that it does omit a phrase. It omits, looking at it now, the phrase doesn't occur to me, which it omits. Oh, yes, the fact that they were seen, well, it does say were seen by many. I was thinking that phrase was omitted. But the seen by many is by many who passed by the way on the way back to the city. This, we feel, probably is the simplest answer to the whole puzzle of Matthew 27. That the event that really happened was when Jesus died, that particular earthquake, not the earthquake at his resurrection, but the earthquake at his death, was of such magnitude that it actually cracked open tombs. Now, these tombs would have been tombs lying on the north of the east side of the Mount Moriah, going into the Kidron Valley, and the west side of Mount of Olives. And that the bodies in those tombs, with the lids being thrown off, the bodies were cast in an upright position. That individuals did not notice this before Jesus' resurrection because there was no concourse in and out of the city. The gates were closed. Travelers were off the road. It was the high holy days. It was not a time when it was noted. And that after his resurrection, those passing by, as they went to the city, found this and undoubtedly was quite noteworthy because it would cause quite a major influx. So on the Matthew text, and that was the one we are spending the most time with because in many ways it's one of the more obscure texts. We feel that This probably is the most logical explanation, although we've looked at several possibilities. You know, sometimes it is not an obscure text that causes problems. Sometimes we can have problems with a very obvious text, but as you look in one translation for another, you're amazed at how they translate it. And you say, how did they get that thought? And one example of this that we're going to look at next, our second text we're going to treat, is in the book of Daniel. One of the most used texts by Bible students, Daniel 12:4. But thou, O Daniel, shut up the words and seal the book, even to the time of the end. Many shall run to and fro, and knowledge shall be increased. How many times have we used this text? How many times do we still use it? I love this text. I think it's one of the nicest texts to show the indicators of the time of the end and the Lord's return. But there are two phrases in the text that are not easy of translation. The phrases that once run to and fro and knowledge shall be increased, the phrase we use the most. Now, the thought of run to and fro and knowledge increased is in the majority of translations. It's in the Masoretic. It's in Young's Literal. It's the Revised Standard, Rotherham, the New International, the American Standard. Fenton translates it travel, and I like that. That's a nice translation. A Living Bible uses travel. Leiser uses roam about. And the Douay, the Catholic version, uses pass over. All similar thoughts involving the thought of transport. However, the same phrase is translated fall away. Very different thought in the American translation, which translates it, many shall prove disloyal. And in Moffat's, many shall give way. And there is considerable evidence in commentators for that particular translation. It's not an untrue thought. It's very true that one of the signs of the Lord's return is a great apostasy. Many would pass away. Many would fall away from the faith. This is a very true statement, very much in harmony with the content of the latter part of Daniel 11, where he talks about a major falling away just before. It's translated study in the Variorum. Lane's commentary gives that as an option. And the Septuagint says, many shall be taught the thought of study. And the phrase, knowledge shall be increased, in the American translation in Moffat, is translated, troubles shall abound. Now you notice that all three thoughts that are suggested here are proper thoughts. It isn't a case of choosing and saying, oh, that's not true. That's obviously not correct. It's very true that at the time of the end, there is an increase in travel, an increase of knowledge. It's very true at the time of the end, there is a great apostasy and an increase of troubles. In fact, it ties in very well, Daniel 12:1. At that time, shall Michael stand up and there shall be a time of trouble. And it's very true that there is an increase, as there never been before, in Bible study particularly, but in study of all times, which is directly related to the concept of knowledge being increased. You notice that the two translators who translate knowledge shall be increased as troubles are the same two translators who translate run to and fro as fall away. Because they are trying to be consistent within their translation, the two thoughts being connected one with another. Many shall fall away and troubles shall abound. Now in this case, where you have three very acceptable, very correct concepts, how do you determine which one's intended? Well, let's look at some notes on this. And perhaps they will help to show us the breadth of meaning that's in the words. First, we're going to quote from the Notes of Wordsworth, volume 6, page 61. And this is on the phrase, run to and fro. The Hebrew word shut, here used, signifies to traverse the sea as merchants do in ships, in order to visit distant lands and find merchandise there. It's used in Zechariah 4:10, the eyes of the Lord run to and fro. 2 Chronicles 16:9 is almost the same. Amos 8:12, they shall run to and fro to seek the work of the Lord. We especially like that Amos 8:12 verse, because you notice how supportive it is of connecting the running to and fro with the increase of knowledge. It's not a running to and fro of general helter-skelter travel, but it's a running to and fro for the object of seeking the word of the Lord. It's an intense search that brings about a going back and a going forth. But notice the idiom that it's taken from, to traverse the sea. Now, others writing on that same word, on the origin of the word, say that the word was coined in the harbor of Joppa to discuss the motion of ships coming and going, always in, always out, the constant motion of these ships. They would say the ships, we would use the word shuttle. They use the word shoot. They use the word go to and fro. Later, you know, words take on broader meanings than just their definition. I find the simplest one to describe it with is our phrase, hit the nail on the head. We all know what the phrase means, and none of us pick up a hammer to do it. We do it with our mouth. We do it with being succinct and to the point. So in later times, this word came to have an idiomatic usage, describing, as it is used in Zechariah 4:10, the motion of the eyes going back and forth, not to and fro through the earth in this case, but across the pages of a book, reading. Many shall study, a very logical extension of the same word. Every ship that came in left. Many shall fall away. The departure again is there. Although the Companion Bible has a different thought as to why the fall away came in. And we thought it's worthy of note. The Hebrew shut, to rove, turn about, despise. Hence to do despite. Notice the different meaning in Ezekiel 16:37, 28, 24, and 26. But if we spell it soot with an S instead of an SH, the meaning is to swerve, turn aside, apostatize. Those who turn aside are revolters. And that word is used in Psalm 101:3, Hosea 5:2, in Psalm 40, verse 4, such as turn aside to lies. Now, the difference in those two letters is only dots over the letter. I change it from one to the other. It forms no part of the inspired primitive text. Now, they were added by the scribes. The vowel points were gradually introduced into the Hebrew text. So, as a result, either one becomes possible. Those of you who are familiar with Polish, you notice that the S without the, what do you call that thing on top of it? Can't think of the name of that little character up there. Is S, and with it on it, it's sh. Similar. Very similar thought. Just a dot point difference, changing it from the S to the SH concept and sound. So that all three translations are permissible concepts. They are thoughts that may work. Personally, I prefer accepted King James. I think the thought of to and fro is a well-taken thought. I think that the Amos 8:12 becomes a beautiful confirmation of the connecting of the kind of running to and fro he's talking about. It is an intense search for the knowledge, for the answer to the puzzle as to the time of the end and the doctrines that are connected. What's next? Is that Daniel? Okay. Our third text. I wasn't sure if we had one more transparency in this text or not. Our third text deals with another very familiar scripture. John 1:1. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. A text that is so frequently used by Trinitarians to prove the Trinity. And if any of you have talked with Trinitarians and tried to utilize one of the explanations we've so frequently utilized, which we don't necessarily think is wrong, you may have run into some problems. You may have run into some who say that is not admissible in the Greek. Certainly, as you look at the text to begin with, the text is far from proving Trinity. Because not only was the Word was God, however that phrase is to be translated, and that's the phrase we're going to look at, but the Word was with God. And if they're the same, identical, and one is with the other one, then God is beside himself. It's a concept that he paints that is a very difficult concept. Although a truly versed person in the Trinity will have a very quick answer for that, and that is they do not view the Trinity as three identical personages, but three of the same nature, three that are linked essentially or in essence, but not in personality. There are three possible explanations for this text. The one we most frequently use is number one, that Jesus was a subordinate God, a God, as opposed to the God. A A second explanation that is used by even Trinitarians is that the construction in the Greek here means that it's adjectival. It means he possessed godlike qualities. A third explanation is that Jesus, as the Logos, represented God. We're going to look at each of these three in detail, but before we do, we would like to notice one thing. Any of the three explanations fits completely with our theology. Let's look at the first. Our favorite source to start discussion in the first, of course, is the emphatic dialect. And we're going to use the emphatic dialect here. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with the God, and a God was the Word. We say, note the distinction. You have the God, Jehovah, and he's not saying that the one who was with the God is the God, but he is a mighty one. He is also a God. And that, theologically, is extremely sound. We think that it's a correct concept, a very correct viewpoint. Whether it's the viewpoint presented in John 1:1 is the point we're trying to look at right now. Now, supporting our thought, C.H. Dodd, writing in the periodical New Testament Translation Problems, that's his article title, Technical Papers for the Bible Translator is the magazine, Volume 1, Number 7 of January 1977. Speaking about the Diglot translation, says, as a word-for-word translation, it cannot be faulted. He agrees that the concept is a concept that is admissible from a translator standpoint. He spends the rest of his article proving why it's wrong. And basically, he says, it's not theologically acceptable. Not to him. But he does support the thought that it is not a translation that cannot be defended. It may not be the most defensible, but it is defensible. The concept of the verse, and I think this we need to take into account, is that what John is introducing his gospel with is a description of the role of Jesus in his pre-human existence as the Logos. And the Logos, I think, we can see well identified in history, where it was ever used as a person who represented another person, a spokesman. However, as a theological term, the Logos apparently was introduced in contemporary writings of the time by a philosopher named Philo. And his introduction of it, he was introducing it in very much the same way that we use this text, as a subordinate god. He called it a deuterotheos, a second god, a god who was under, subordinate to, Jehovah, the main God, although he didn't call the main God Jehovah, but subordinate to the Jehovah concept. Almost all the commentators note this, that the concept is picked up from Philo. They say, but no way is John talking what Philo was talking about a subordinate God, even though the language totally supports. But Adolf Harnack, who is probably the topmost authority on the history of doctrine in the Christian church, admits that the idea of the subordinate God is as old as the Christian church. That as old as the church, there was this thought that you have a God who is above all gods, Jehovah. And then you have a mighty one whom he created under him. So there is scholarship to back up the concept that we most frequently use. Not only is there scholarship, there is potentially a scripture to back us up. A supportive text with somewhat parallel reasoning. And that's in the same first chapter of John. We're going to look at John 1:18. We're going to read it from the Nestle Marshall translation because it's very different than the King James. God, no man has seen never. And don't worry about the double negative there. In the Greek, the double negative is not a problem. The only begotten, you notice the, he says, is not in the Greek. The only begotten God, the one he inserts, being in the bosom of the Father, that one declared, and then he says, maybe we should insert him. He puts a question mark in his insertion of him. The King James has, or the number one, is a very definite difference. No man has seen God at any time, the only begotten Son, which is in the bosom of the Father, he hath declared him. Now, the manuscripts that support the Nestles, among many, The P66, which is one of the oldest papyri manuscripts available, 2nd century, has Theos, God. The Sinaiticus, which we rely on so heavily, has God. The Ephraimi, which is so-so manuscript, has God. The Regis, which is not so important, and the Syrian Peshitta and the Ethiopian are among those that have the thought of God. In addition, some manuscripts read even stronger. The only begotten, the God, or the only begotten God, as the interpolation is by Nestle's. That's supported by the Papyrus 75, which is a very early manuscript, the revision of the Sinaiticus, the Minuscule 33, and the Coptic. The only ones supporting the rendering of the King James, Son, are the Alexandrian, which is a fairly old manuscript, 5th century, the Ephraimi revision, and then manuscripts from the 10th century on are almost unanimous in supporting Son. So the manuscript evidence is very strong for the Nestle Marshall, that he is called the only begotten God. And notice how beautifully that supports John 1:1 as we look at it. There is a God above all gods, and then there is a begotten God. And there's only one of them. There's only one begotten God, as opposed to a concept of indirect creation, but a direct offshoot of the original God. One who could really be called, as later translators bring it up, the Son of God. This gives us, within the context, a reason to say, yes, John himself is discussing two individuals who both warrant the title of God. Not that there are two Jehovahs, two Almighties, but as Jesus himself said regarding his defense of, I am the Son of God, God called your judges gods. You say I blaspheme because I say I'm the Son of God? That the term God by itself is not a sanctified term only used of Jehovah. The term God is used in many ways. Satan is the god of this world. It's used of anyone who holds an extremely high and important position. That position has the thought of a mighty one, an El, a God. And so therefore there is this additional support. The second option, and we're going to quote from the concepts of William Barclay, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and what God was, the Word was. And defending this, quoting from Barclay's Gospel of John, John did not say that the Word was Hotheos. That would have been to say that the Word was identical with God. He says the Word was Theos, without the definite article, which means that the Word was, as we might say, of the very same character, quality, essence, being as God. When John said the Word was God, he was not saying that Jesus is identical with God. He was saying that Jesus is so perfectly the same as God in mind, in heart, and in being, that in Jesus we perfectly see what God is like. Surprising statement for a Trinitarian to make. And Barclay is a Trinitarian. But in making this statement, he is dealing honestly with the problem of the lack of the definite article. And to many Greek scholars who say that the concept of putting a subordinate God, the God and a God, is somewhat strained in the Greek, they have to admit that there has to be a reason for it. But we're going to digress here for just a few minutes, because some of you may be talking with those who are quite versed in the Trinity. And it's at this point that a person versed in the Trinity may throw at you a very complex argument. They may say, you don't know what you're talking about. In the Greek, there is what is known as Kowal's rule of the Greek. And this rule states that whenever the subject is put into the predicate, when the subject of the sentence is put in the last position, as it is in the state, in the structure, the Word was God. The Greek is God was the Word. That it never requires the definite article. And therefore, the definite article is meaningless. Kowal wrote this article in 1938. In his article, he states the exceptions to his rule. There are some 63 in number. Almost more times than the rule applies. So what he is saying is, sometimes it does not require a definite article. There are many times where it does. At the very best, all his argument does is neutralize our position. It does not take it away. At the worst, it's somewhat phony, and we're inclined to the thought that it is. But we do want to note, for those of you who are familiar and have heard of Kolwa's rule, that in his article, he states the number of exceptions, and he lists them all, and they are almost more numerous than the time when the rule applies. So the rule is not a rule to disagree with what Barclay is saying. Even Langes, which is strongly Trinitarian, agrees. Theos without the article signifies divine essence, the generic idea of God, a God, in distinction from man or angel. As Sarx in verse 14, where he becomes flesh, signifies the essence of, or human nature of the Logos. The article before Theos would here destroy the distinction of personality and confound the Father with the Son. The third possibility. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word represented God. Now that would take care of all the problem, wouldn't it? And it's not inadmissible. It has a parallel construction in a very familiar text, the memorial. Take, eat, this is my body. The Greek language, like the English language, recognize in the verb to be a sense of representation. If I say, this is a rule, you know this is not a rule. This is a stick of wood that I'm saying represents a rule. If he said, this is my body, we say, this is representation of my body. In the argument of John 1:1, in the beginning was the Logos, a representation of God. And this Logos was beside, representing God, and this Logos represented God. It fits the context beautifully. It is an argument that does have a potential value. For ourselves, we prefer the adjective concept, the Barclay concept, as being the most defensible. This is second, but our usual one is also defensible, as being one that we can support, especially with the John 18 context. So, brethren, we have not tried to narrow any of these discussions down to very solid, hard and fast answers. We've tried to honestly look at the breadth of problems that certain texts present. We try to investigate them in a certain amount of clarity and honesty, and to leave the final conclusions for your feeling, for your study, and recognize that these are only a sampling of many of the scriptures that sometimes need a little more research than just being taken directly on the surface.